From outside the Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C., this is Democracy Now!
More than 54 years ago, at the height of the Cold War, the United States closed its embassy in Havana. Today, I can announce that the United States has agreed to formally reestablish diplomatic relations with the Republic of Cuba and reopen embassies in our respective countries.
Hey, here in Washington, D.C. and Havana, as the United States and Cuba officially restore diplomatic relations and reopen their embassies. As we broadcast from outside the Cuban embassy here in Washington, we speak with Cuban attorney Jose Percheira, the actor and activist Danny Glover, activist Medea Benjamin, and journalist and historian Peter Kornbluh.
This is a historic moment in bilateral relations. It's a historic moment for Latin America as a whole, and it's certainly an extraordinary kind of change of events in the whole history of U.S. foreign policy.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. At least 8 Afghan soldiers have died in a so-called friendly fire incident after 2 U.S. helicopters attacked a checkpoint in broad daylight earlier today. General Abdul Razik, a senior Afghan National Army commander, said, quote, it seems the attack was carried out mistakenly on Army forces and an investigation is ongoing to find its reason. While the United States has claimed to have ended its combat mission in Afghanistan, the military carried out 106 airstrikes last month, more than double the number carried out in May. Greek banks have reopened for the first time in 3 weeks, just days after the Greek parliament approved harsh austerity measures in exchange for a new bailout. The Greek stock market remains closed. Meanwhile, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has replaced nearly a dozen cabinet members and Syriza party officials who voted against last week's bailout deal. On Friday, Tsipras ousted the energy minister, the labor minister, and former government spokesperson, as well as at least 8 additional ministers or deputy ministers. U.S.-Cuban diplomatic relations have officially been restored after 5 decades. In an historic gesture, the Cuban flag was raised at the State Department earlier today. Events are being held today to mark the opening of the Cuban embassy in Washington and the U.S. embassy in Havana. We'll have more on the story after headlines as we broadcast from outside the Cuban embassy here in the nation's capital. The death toll from last week's mass shooting at military sites in Chattanooga, Tennessee, has risen to 5. The victims include 4 Marines and 1 sailor. On Friday night, more than 1,000 people attended a memorial service. The FBI is continuing to investigate the possible motive of the suspected gunman, Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, who died in a firefight following the mass shooting. ABC News is reporting that FBI interviews with his parents and a diary belonging to Abdulaziz paint a picture of a disturbed, suicidal young man who used drugs and was preparing for bankruptcy. In Yemen, dozens of people have been killed in the ongoing battle over control over the southern city of Aden. On Sunday, Houthi fighters fired rockets into one of the city's residential neighborhoods, killing at least 43 people. Sunday's assault came 2 days after the Saudi-backed forces loyal to the exiled government declared they'd taken control of Aden. Meanwhile, another 24 people were killed in Saudi-led airstrikes in the Ibb district of Yemen over the weekend. 12 of the bombing's victims were members of the same family. In eastern Iraq, the self-proclaimed Islamic State has claimed responsibility for a marketplace bombing that killed 100 people, with dozens more missing or wounded. The attack was carried out Friday in the Shiite town north of Baghdad. It struck as the market was filled with people shopping for the celebration of Eid al-Fitr, a major Muslim holiday that marks the end of Ramadan. In Turkey, 27 people have been killed and more than 100 more wounded in a bombing earlier today in the Turkish border town of Shirut in what appears to be a targeted attack against youth activists. The bombing was carried out in the garden of a cultural center where hundreds of activists from the Federation of Socialist Youth Associations were staying. the youth activists were living in Suruj to help the rebuilding of the nearby Syrian town of Koban, which has been the site of intense fighting between the self-proclaimed Islamic State and Kurdish forces. In campaign news, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has come under intense criticism from within his own party after he spoke disparagingly about the war record of Republican Senator John McCain, who was held as a prisoner of war in Vietnam for over 5 years. During an event in Iowa Saturday, Trump said he did not view Senator McCain as a war hero.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
Do you agree with that?
He's a war hero because he was captured.
Keep it lower. Trump has refused to apologize for his comment. Unlike McCain, Trump did not serve in Vietnam. He received 4 student deferments between 1964 and 1968. In more campaign news, members of the Black Lives Movement staged a protest inside the Netroots Nation conference in Phoenix, Arizona, by repeatedly interrupting Democratic presidential candidates Senator Bernie Sanders and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. Members of the Black Lives Movement interrupted O'Malley's portion of the event and took to the stage.
Let me be clear. Every single day, folks are dying. Not being able to take another breath. We are in a state of emergency. We are in a state of emergency. And if you don't feel that emergency, you are not human.
After the interruption, Governor Martin O'Malley responded by saying, "Black lives matter, white lives matter, all lives matter." He later apologized for the comment. Senator Sanders threatened to leave the stage after protesters repeatedly interrupted his remarks. Meanwhile, Sanders continues to draw record crowds on the campaign trail. On Saturday night, more than 11,000 people attended his speech in Phoenix, his largest ever, and by far the largest crowd in either the Republican or Democratic presidential campaign rallies. The family of Sandra Bland, who died in police custody in Texas last week, has ordered an independent autopsy to be conducted. Bland died in a Texas jail cell 3 days after being pulled over for a traffic violation as she drove to a job interview at her alma mater, the historically black college Prairie View A&M University. County officials say Bland committed suicide in jail. But family members and friends have questioned the cause of her death. Video from the traffic stop show a police officer slammed her head into the ground. On Saturday, hundreds of people gathered outside Brooklyn's federal courthouse to mark the first anniversary of Eric Garner's death and to call for the arrest and prosecution of police officer Daniel Pantaleo, who placed Eric Garner in a fatal police chokehold 1 year ago.
We stand together today by the hundreds saying we don't care how long it takes. We want justice for Eric Garner. We can't breathe, and we need to breathe.
Saturday's rally came after an hours-long march throughout Manhattan on Friday evening. Meanwhile, New York City announced earlier last week it had settled with the Garner family for $5.9 million. Following the announcement, Eric Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, said, quote, "Don't congratulate us. This is not a victory. The victory will come when we get justice," she said. In news from South Carolina, thousands of people flooded the statehouse as the new Black Panther Party and the Ku Klux Klan held 2 separate protests Saturday. At least 5 people were arrested as heavily armed police officers surrounded the area and stood guard on nearby rooftops. Members of the Ku Klux Klan and the loyal White Knights performed Nazi salutes and carried flags bearing swastikas in what was reported to be the first KKK rally outside the South Carolina Statehouse in Columbia in over a quarter of a century. Saturday's opposing protest came 8 days after the Confederate battle flag was removed from the statehouse grounds. In news from Africa, the trial of the former dictator of Chad has begun in Senegal. Hissène Habré is a former U.S. ally who has been described as Africa's Pinochet. He is accused of killing as many as 40,000 people during his 8 years in power in the 1980s in Chad. Habre is being tried in a special court established after a 20-year-long campaign led by his victims. Attorney Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch, who's worked with victims of Habre's regime since 1999, praised the start of the trial.
This is a chance to show that an African court can deliver justice for African victims for crimes committed in Africa. I mean, it's one thing to complain about having abusive African presidents and leaders sent to The Hague. It's another thing to show that they can be prosecuted and get a fair trial here in Africa.
Newly unsealed legal testimony shows comedian Bill Cosby admitted in a lengthy 2005 deposition that he used his fame and money to lure young women to have sex with him. In the testimony, he also admitted to giving young women sedatives. When asked about nonverbal consent, Cosby said, quote, "I think I'm a pretty decent reader of people and their emotions and their romantic sexual things, whatever you want to call them," he said. More than 40 women have alleged Cosby sexually assaulted them in incidents dating back decades. Many say they were drugged by Cosby and then raped. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Washington, D.C., where history is being made today. In a major diplomatic thaw, Cuba will raise its flag here and officially reopen its embassy after 54 years. Hundreds are gathering for this historic moment, including U.S. and Cuban lawmakers and diplomats, activists and artists, scholars and historians. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez is leading a delegation of over two dozen officials from Havana, including Cuba's chief negotiator, Josefina Vidal. Also among the attendees is Cuban singer-songwriter Silvia Rodriguez and former parliament president Ricardo Alarcón. This afternoon, Rodriguez will hold a joint news conference with Secretary of State John Kerry at the State Department, where Cuba's flag was raised earlier this morning, joining the flags of more than 150 other countries that have diplomatic relations with the United States. In Havana, the U.S. Embassy will also reopen its doors today. Kerry is set to travel there later this summer for the formal inauguration ceremony, where the U.S. flag will be hoisted. Cubans have welcomed the diplomatic rapprochement with jubilation. This is Professor Alberto Matos.
For us, this is significant. It's important. I think it's a decisive step towards normalizing relations. In other words, as Cubans, we celebrate this and are waiting to see what could happen and what could continue from this point on, which we are optimistic will be things that are feasible for the Cuban people and the people of the United States.
The Cuban embassy, which I am standing just across the street from, was built in 1917, almost 100 years ago, becoming the first diplomatic building in this neighborhood and helping to establish this area as a diplomatic center. Fidel Castro visited the embassy in 1959 after he overthrew Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista. 2 years later, in 1961, the United States unilaterally broke off relations with Cuba. The last time the United States and Cuba had diplomatic ties, President Dwight Eisenhower was in office. Today's opening of embassies is just the first step in normalizing relationships between the two countries. On Wednesday, Cuban President Raul Castro applauded the diplomatic renewal, but called on President Obama to use his executive powers to remove the ongoing U.S. trade and financial embargo.
The revolutionary government has the willingness to advance in normalizing relations, convinced that both countries can cooperate and coexist in a civilized manner for mutual benefit beyond differences that we have and that we will have and contribute to peace. We hope that the U.S. president continues to use his executive powers that he can use as president without congressional interference to dismantle aspects of this policy that has damaged and caused hardship to our people.
That was Cuban President Raul Castro. So far, the Republican majority in Congress has rejected President Obama's calls to lift the U.S. embargo on Cuba. Obama's congressional opponents have also vowed to block any ambassadorial nominee to Cuba and have denounced the decision to formally remove Cuba from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. Today, three Cuban-American lawmakers, Florida Republican Representatives Mario Diaz-Balart, Carlos Scribello, and Ileana Ross-Leighton, are holding a news conference in Miami. Ross-Leighton told The Wall Street Journal, quote, "Allowing the opening of the Cuban embassy in Washington is nothing but another indefensible capitulation by the Obama administration to an avowed enemy of the U.S." Meanwhile, White House spokesperson Josh Earnest has dismissed such opponents as a vocal minority with entrenched partisan interests. Speaking Friday, Earnest said U.S. restoration of relations with Cuba has strong support in Congress.
There exists bipartisan support for advancing the policy that the president announced to normalize our relations with Cuba. But there have been some entrenched partisan interests that have tried to block this in Congress so far. Fortunately, there are a number of steps that the president can take using his executive authority to begin to make these changes. The president is implementing these changes because he believes it's in the broader strategic interest of the United States.
For more, we're joined now by Jose Pertierra. He is a Cuban attorney based in Washington, D.C., who represented Elian Gonzalez in 2000-2001. He also represented the Venezuelan government in his efforts to extradite Luis Posada Carriles. And we're joined by Peter Kornbluh, who directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive at George Washington University. He's the co-author of the book Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, an updated version of the book that tells the secret story of how Obama used back-channel diplomacy to normalize diplomatic relations and particularly looks at the role of the Pope in the back-channel negotiations. Will be published in September. Jose Pertierra and Peter Kornbluh, it's so good to have you with us on this truly historic day. People who are watching, listening right now, hear all the traffic. We're right across the street from the Cuban embassy, which will soon hoist the Cuban flag for the first time in Washington, D.C., on the Cuban embassy grounds in 54 years. Jose Pertierra, you're a Cuban-American. Talk about the significance of this.
Oh, this is very significant. This is historic. I waited for this moment all my life. In 1961, I was 10 years old, and I remember as if it was yesterday when diplomatic relations were broken. There were times when I thought I'd never live to see the day. And now that you mention flags, Amy, it's interesting. There's going to be a new Cuban flag hoisted in this flagpole across the street. But inside the embassy, they are going to hoist the flag that the Cuban government took back to Cuba when on January 3rd, 1961, Dwight Eisenhower broke relations. That flag was folded, taken back to Cuba, and put in a museum in Las Tunas. And it has been brought back, and it will be flying inside the embassy today.
Why did Dwight Eisenhower, the president of the United States, cut off relations?
The United States, I think, has had a problem, as you know, and this show has presented to the world knowledge of that. The United States feels that it owns a large part of Latin America, and it was very hard for the United States to stomach a revolution that said Cuba is an independent and sovereign country and set an example for the rest of Latin America. I think, really, there were a lot of reasons, but that really was at the time the reason and has been the reason why diplomatic relations have not been restored until President Obama did so on December 17th.
Peter Kornbluh, can you weigh in on that?
Well, I can weigh in a little bit, but I just want to say thank you for having us here on this momentous day. There are a lot of people that never really thought they'd live to see today come, and so many people have worked for this day to arrive, and here it is right now. You know, the more sinister reason that Eisenhower broke relations was because the United States was preparing to invade Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. And Fidel Castro had his intelligence agents in Central America reporting on these preparations. And he decided he wasn't going to let the U.S. Embassy be a nest of spies, as he put it. And he was going to tell the United States they had to remove almost, I don't know, I think 70% of the embassy personnel, cut the embassy way down so that it wouldn't be a center of this espionage and preparations for the attack. And Eisenhower seized the opportunity of Fidel expelling all of these people who were, in fact, working to overthrow the Cuban government. He seized on that opportunity as a public relations kind of hook to say, well, we can't take this insult. We're just going to break relations with Cuba. Things have changed in the 54 years since. And now the real work begins, I think, to actually normalize overall relations beyond just diplomatic relations.
Because let's be clear, the embargo has not been lifted, and that would have to go through Congress. Is that right, Jose Patera? Is there any other way?
Well, the president has a great deal of authority under the Constitution to further relax the restrictions of the embargo. But you're right, Amy, the embargo was codified by President Clinton in a move that it seems unfathomable that a president would make, that stripped not only his powers, but the power of future presidents to, by executive order, lift restrictions against Cuba. They codified it, and it's sitting in Congress, and it's very difficult to do it when you have a Republican majority Congress, especially a Republican Party that has gone off the cliff in the last few years.
I think what President Obama is trying to do is use his executive powers to poke holes in this dam that is the U.S. embargo. And the holes are going to grow bigger and bigger as the kind of economic waters and cultural, social waters of U.S. interests, various interests, you know, the people's interests, musicians' interests.
Sylvia Rodriguez is part of the official delegation,
exactly,
the great Cuban
exactly.
musician.
And certainly economic interests. There are quite a few corporations and the hotel industry, the shipping industry, the carnival cruise industry that would like to get into Cuba. And as they rush through the holes in the dam that Obama has created, the dam that is the embargo, I think is going to erode and eventually collapse. And you're going to have Republicans saying, yeah, I think it doesn't make sense to restrict trade with Cuba.
The business of America is business, isn't that what they say?
I mean, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been pushing for the lifting of
the embargo. Carlos Gutierrez, who was what Secretary of Commerce under Bush, has come up in favor of the lifting of the blockade. So, yeah, it's a tidal wave.
You know, because of course, business has no politics in the end. It is, it's there to make money, and people see opportunities in Cuba. So, but the point is that we can make great strides towards better relations and normal relations with Cuba, even with the embargo in place. I think we have to be patient about that. There are a lot of other serious issues, actually, that Cuba and the United States are going to be discussing from this day onward. Compensation for expropriated property, the whole issue of Guantanamo, the USAID programs that are focused on promoting democracy in Cuba that are a great insult to Cuba's sovereignty. These are things that going forward are still going to be under discussion, but let me just say, they're going to be under discussion under a different framework of relations, a framework of normal, non-hostile civil ties.
We're going to go to break and then come back. We'll continue with Jose Patera, learn about his story, how he came to the United States with his family from Cuba, representing Elian Gonzalez, and also representing the Venezuelan government in efforts to extradite Luis Posada Caliles, who still lives today in Florida. And Peter Kornbluh, also joining us, the head of the Cuba Documentation Project National Security Archive, co-author of the book Back Channel to Cuba. We'll be joined by Danny Glover and longtime activist Medea Benjamin. They are holding Medea Benjamin and Code Pink, a party outside the embassy today that will go throughout the day and the afternoon. Meanwhile, inside the embassy, 700 people will gather. As the flag is hoisted for the first time, the Cuban flag on the Cuban embassy property in 54 years. Stay with us.
El hombre bebe en una copa ancha aunque no cabe el peso de su extraña gracia y brinda por la muerte de su abril. Después se sube a un sitio inexpugnable y canta un canto que suena agradable mientras por dentro vuelve a maldecir. De su única tierra, de su propio enemigo en esta nueva guerra, el hombre vio su rostro sucumbir. Quizá ahora hoy en la casa de la historia que se revise el trono de porque un hombre sin rostro va a morir.
That is Silvio Rodriguez. Silvio Rodriguez is part of the official Cuban delegation today that is led by Bruno Rodriguez, the Cuban foreign minister, who will be here at the embassy honoring the opening of the Cuban embassy and the hoisting of the Cuban flag in Washington, D.C. Our guests now, coming up, Medea Benjamin and actor Danny Glover, long an activist on the issue of Cuba. Our Jose Pertera, Cuban attorney here in Washington, D.C., Representative Elian Gonzalez, and also represented the Venezuelan government in its efforts to extradite Luis Posada Carriles. Peter Kornbluh is also with us, directs the Cuba Documentation Project, the National Security Archive. If you would talk, Jose, about how you came to this country.
Amy, my mother fled Cuba with my father, but she was fleeing from her mother-in-law, not from the revolution. She hated her mother-in-law. And she convinced my father to leave Cuba. We arrived in Miami, as so many Cubans do. And at the time, there was a program in Miami run by the United States government for Cuban refugees. And they would fly a Cuban family to live anywhere in the United States. They'd give them a one-way ticket as long as they promised not to live in Miami. I guess they were worried, even back in 1961, of what would happen to Miami if Cuban Americans stayed there. And so we went to California, in Los Angeles, and I grew up with the philosophy of Cesar Chavez instead of Jorge Mascanosa, I think.
And Jorge Mascanosa, for those who don't know or remember?
Is the leader of the president of the Cuban American National Foundation, very right-wing extremist guy who was a friend of Reagan and Bush and so forth. And, I think that my mother's move to California saved my life. Otherwise, I'd have grown up in Miami.
You have two cigars. You're holding one.
I'm holding one.
And this one. Yeah.
And you've got one in your pocket. The significance of these cigars. Are they legal right now?
Yes, they're legal. If you bring, you can bring $100 worth of cigars into the United States from Cuba, but you can't bring them in from a third country. You have to bring them in directly from
Amy, Peter Cormier.
More and more, Americans are traveling to Cuba now because Obama has said that he has lifted some of the restrictions on travel, made it easier to travel. But there's still an overall law against free travel to Cuba, and that is one of the things that absolutely has to change if we're going to have normal relations and if U.S. citizens are going to be able to exercise their constitutional freedoms to go wherever they want. Cuba is really the only country now that we are restricted from vacationing in. But more and more American citizens are going, U.S. citizens, they're buying cigars, drinking rum, listening to the music.
And there are direct flights.
JetBlue is starting direct flights. There's going to be the Carnival Cruise Line is actually going to start going to Cuba by taking kind of people-to-people groups instead of vacationers. I mean, we are seeing a ferry service is starting up again. That there used to be a historic ferry service between Key West and Miami and Cuba, and now it's starting up again. I mean, you are seeing it so fast, the way it's changing, the way these two countries are becoming connected again, and it's really, really something.
Jose Pertera, you fought for this, but you're also raising some warning flags.
I'm cautiously optimistic, Amy. I'm optimistic about the future. I think that President Obama's move in December 17 and today is irreversible, no matter who gets elected president. However, things can go wrong, and the United States needs to have a president who will exercise his presidential authority to get rid of a number of programs that are damaging to U.S.-Cuba relations, such as, for example, the regime change program that, to the tune of more than $30 million a year, seeks to change the government of Cuba. There are also things that...
This is millions of dollars the U.S. government puts in to change the government.
The Congress mandates get spent on Cuba under the Helms-Burton law.
And, what they do with that is they pay dissidents in Cuba and in Miami. Opposition to the Cuban Revolution in Miami is an industry. People make money and live very comfortably as a result of it. So the United States needs to get rid of those programs and move forward and respect the sovereignty of Cuba. Cuba does not belong to the United States. Maybe Mississippi does, but Cuba does not.
Luis Posada Cariles, you represent the Venezuelan government. Can you explain, Jose, who he is and his significance even today?
Luis Posada Cariles, Amy, was the Osama bin Laden of Latin America. He was responsible for a campaign of terror against Cuba dating all the way back to the late 60s, early 1970s, up until very recently. He directed a campaign of bombs in hotels and restaurants in Cuba that resulted in injuries and death.
I was in Cuba at the Copacabana Hotel after the Italian tourist
Fabio
was killed
Lichoma.
In one of those bombings. His father would not leave the area of the lobby
That's
where
exactly
his son
right.
died.
He moved to Cuba. He told me, Justino told me, I moved to Cuba because if I live anywhere else, I feel that Fabio has died. But in Cuba, I feel his spirit. And he also, Posada Cariles was also responsible for downing an airliner with 73 people on board. Everybody was killed.
This was 1976.
Exactly. Including a 9-year-old girl was murdered there.
And the entire Cuban fencing team.
And the entire Cuban youth fencing team with their medals on their chest. They had
but
won
they had just
all
won.
The gold, silver, and bronze medals at the Pan American Games.
In Venezuela.
In Venezuela. And they were
and
flying
they were
back
flying
to Cuba
back.
Singing and... these bombs went off, and the United States continues to protect this man in Miami, him and many other Cuban exiled terrorists who live in Miami. Miami is the favorite place for Cuban terrorists to go hang out and retire. And, you know, that's something that is a problem in U.S.-Cuba relations, as is Guantanamo, because...
It's likely today there'll be a small protest in Miami, very small, and that by anti-Castro Cubans. But Luis Posada Cariles might show up. And the fact of the matter is that the United States has been harboring an international terrorist that even the CIA, FBI documents show was behind the explosion on this plane.
And you look at other moments in U.S. history, Watergate break-in, the involvement of Cuban exiles there.
The Letelier assassination down the street here.
So explain. Orlando Letelier, the Chilean diplomat, and Ronnie Moffitt, his assistant.
Killed by agents of the Pinochet government working with these anti-Castro terrorists, collaborating.
That, too, was
the
in 1976.
Was set off by
is that right?
That's
Cuban
right. The people who pushed the
and
bomb.
And that was right here. I mean, where
right down, it, the street.
Down on Embassy Row.
Right.
Their bomb. Their
There's
car
a whole history, but
up.
Let me just say, I really want to say, I this history is going to be part of a past that certainly we all have to remember. As long as Posada Cariles is in this country without justice, without being prosecuted, without being extradited, that history lives on. But the United States and Cuba are poised today to move forward, to keep working on these issues of the past that include Posada Cariles and the embargo, but to move forward in a much different way. And the fact that these flags are flying, they're flying in a different wind, aren't they, Jose Pertierra? The winds of change have come to U.S.-Cuban relations, and we really can't forget that as much and as dramatic as the past is between these two countries.
Well,
Jose
Pertierra, right.
Your own car was bombed. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
When was it blown up?
But that wasn't the Cuban.
Those are Guatemalans.
Those are Guatemalans.
Explain
right here
what
in Washington.
Happened.
I was representing an American, Jennifer Harper, whom you've interviewed on this program, and her husband was disappeared and tortured in Guatemala. And
Comandante Everardo.
Comandante Everardo Efraín Bámaca Velázquez is his complete name. And the Guatemalan military put a bomb in my car in the driveway about 4 miles, three or four miles from here, and it blew up. I don't think they meant to kill me because it was at 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning when it exploded, but it meant to scare me off the case. I remained on the case, and the Inter-American Court in San Jose of the OAS found the government of Guatemala culpable for the disappearance, torture of Comandante Everardo, and ordered compensation be paid to his widow, Jennifer.
So explain today, as this flag goes up, what is happening in Havana? Originally, I thought the flags were going to go up around the same time, on this same day, on July 20th, 2015. Now, the U.S. Embassy is going to open there, as is this embassy here today. But the flag won't be hoisted today.
They are waiting to hoist a flag until John Kerry can get off his crutches from having broken his leg, can get beyond the negotiations on Iran, and push those forward and find a day in August to go to Cuba and be there for that ceremony. He will become the highest-ranking U.S. official to travel to Cuba since the Cuban Revolution in 1959. Another major step, another major publicity attraction, another indication of a much more normal relationship with Cuba. And that is due to happen sometime in August, and I think start to create a momentum after Kerry. The Pope is going to go to Cuba in September.
And I think Obama will go to Cuba, too, before his presidency.
And I am sure, I'm going to predict on this show today, that one of the things that Kerry will be doing is doing some advance work for President Obama to go to Cuba, which will be his Nixon in China moment, and really, I think, consolidate these changes in policy.
I agree, Peter. That'll seal the deal, Amy. If he goes to Cuba, it'll be completely irreversible.
Jose Percheri, you mentioned Guantanamo. It's not closing.
It's not closing, and, you know, the...
Over 100 men are still being held there.
People talk about violation of human rights and due process in Cuba, and I tell you, Amy, there is violation of human rights and due process in Cuba, and it's in Guantanamo. I mean, we're holding prisoners there for years without trial, tortured them, and President Obama took the office with a promise that he would close Guantanamo as a prison, and he has not. I think he will before his term is over, but, you know, it's been 6 years, and 6 years of prison for people without trial, 6 years of torture. I think he needs to do something, but beyond that, beyond closing it as a prison, the United States needs to return that territory to Cuba. That is sovereign Cuban territory. The United States has no business there. If they want a base somewhere, they can put it in Mississippi, Alabama, but not in Cuba. Cuba belongs to Cuba, not to Washington.
It's one of the most difficult kind of political issues, I think, for the president. It's kind of last on the list and has been last on the list for all the years of discussions about how to normalize relations with Cuba in terms of kind of the ultimate priority. It's because of the difficulty in negotiating the return of Guantanamo, but eventually that will happen. Guantanamo will become the Panama Canal of Cuba. It will be returned. And kind of the last vestige of physical vestige of U.S. imperialism in the region and in Cuba will be over.
So as we look behind us over the Cuban embassy, there is a flagpole that was just erected a few months ago.
Right.
It's very shiny. There's a gold ball on top. It's ready. And in just an hour or so, there's going to be a Cuban flag waving in the wind.
Well, I want to thank you both for being
with us. Thank you, Amy, for inviting
us. Again on this historic day. 54 years ago, the Cuban embassy was closed. 54 years ago, the flag was pulled down. Today, it will be hoisted once again on July 20th, 2015. Peter Kornbluth, thanks for being with us, director of the Cuba Documentation Project, National Security Archive at George Washington University, co-author of the book Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. And thank you so much to Jose Pertierra. He represented Elian Gonzalez. He represented the government of Venezuela as they tried to extradite Luis Posada Cadiles, who to this day lives in Florida. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Danny Glover, who has long fought for normalization of relations with Cuba, and longtime activist, founder of Code Pink, Medea Benjamin. Stay with us.
Tan lejos que olvidaré mi nombre. Amada, quizás soy otro hombre, más alto y menos viejo, que espera por sí mismo. Allá lejos, allá trepando el dulce abismo. Allá lejos, allá trepando el dulce abismo. Amar, supón que no hay remedio. Es todo lo que intento.
ausencia para el dulce abismo. Y ve que no hay ausencia para el dulce abismo.
Silvio Rodriguez, yes, the great Cuban musician, will be part of the official Cuban delegation today, led by Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez, who will be here in Washington, D.C., at the Cuban embassy as the flag is raised. The Cuban flag will be raised here today for the first time in 54 years. We are here in the area of the diplomatic missions of many countries. The Cuban embassy behind me, we're broadcasting just across the street, became the first diplomatic building in this neighborhood. Fidel Castro visited the embassy in 1959 after he overthrew Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista. He was the toast of the town, invited to receptions all over. 2 years later, in 1961, the United States, under President Dwight Eisenhower, unilaterally broke off relations with Cuba, the last time the U.S. and Cuba had diplomatic ties. Today, the opening of the embassies here in Washington, as well as in Havana, the U.S. embassy there, is just the first step in normalizing relationships between the two countries. Our guests right now are two people who fought for a very long time to see this day, the Cuban flag hoisted in Washington, D.C. Earlier today, it was hoisted at the State Department, so it would be part of the more than 150 flags of countries that the U.S. has diplomatic relations with. Medea Benjamin is with us, longtime political activist, co-founder of Code Pink, and Danny Glover, well-known actor, film director, and political activist. Danny, let's begin with you. Your thoughts on this day. You're about to make your way inside the Cuban embassy.
Viva la Cuba. It is a important day for the Cuban Revolution. It is an important day for the Cuban people, an important day for the American people, and for the world as well. The U.S. has now found itself within the protocol of nations in respecting the Cuban government and respecting the Cuban people and their choice, recognizing that they have differences, but at the same time, there are mutual things that they can talk about as well. But it's an important day. But just the beginning, because the embargo is still in place.
And do you think that embargo any time soon will be lifted? I mean, you have everyone from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to Republican governors who've been going to Cuba, as well as CEO after CEO. A lot of political pressure, a lot of capitalist pressure to open Cuba.
Well, I think the pressure and certainly the process has started. And I see that a number of other things. We're still, the question of Guantanamo is still on the table, too, as well. So there are many things on the table. And I think we're in the beginning of a process right now.
Your thoughts, Medea Benjamin. How many times, Medea, have you been to Cuba?
Well, I lived in Cuba, I mean, from 79 to 83. And then I've been back to Cuba many, many times. The last time was just in May.
Leading major delegations.
Yeah, we took 150 people on our last delegation. We're really encouraging people to go. I mean, you talk about what the future may bring. I think that depends a lot on how much we push. If we encourage people go, you know, it's still illegal to lie on a beach in Cuba. But the more people go, it's illegal to go as a tourist. There are 12 categories. You got to squeeze yourself into one of those categories, which is quite easy now, educational. Anybody can say, I'm going to Cuba for educational purposes. But it's ridiculous that we still have to do that and that there aren't commercial flights. So the more people who go, the more this will be irreversible, the more Congress will feel the pressure. There are hundreds of thousands of Americans who are going to Cuba. The numbers have increased by 50% since last year, just since the announcement was made. But it's now, I think, part of people's political duty as progressives to go to Cuba and just keep this opening, make it grow bigger and bigger.
Airbnbs, there have been 2,000 of them opened in Havana.
And that is fantastic. I mean, to be able to go and stay in a Cuban's home is just wonderful. I mean, you know, Danny, it's just wonderful to go to Cuba anyway. But to understand now that this opening is still not normalized. And if we encourage people to go, if we encourage trade with cooperatives, we as Code Pink, for example, are trading with co-ops right now. We're buying shirts made in Cuba. This is part of encouraging an alternative economy in Cuba, somewhere between the state economy and the private economy. So there's lots we can do to encourage an opening that's good for all of us.
And this change that's happened in Cuba over the last few years, you know, as well, you know, and certainly Medea mentioned the fact that the alternative cooperatives as a stage, it's not simply in creating realizing some sort of form of capitalism here, but cooperatives as a reinforcement of socialism as well.
I wanted to ask about Assata Shakur. The new U.S.-Cuban relations could impact Assata Shakur, the legendary figure within the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army, who now lives in Cuba, where she has political asylum. Assata Shakur was convicted May 2, 1973, killing of a New Jersey state trooper during a shootout that left one of her fellow activists dead. She was shot twice by police during the incident. In 1979, she managed to escape from jail and later fled to Cuba. She's long proclaimed her innocence. In 1998, Democracy Now! Aired her reading an open letter to Pope John Paul II during his trip to Cuba. This is an excerpt.
1977, I was convicted in a trial that can only be described as a legal lynching. In 1979, I was able to escape with the aid of some of my fellow comrades. I saw this as a necessary step, not only because I was innocent of the charges against me, but because I knew that the racist legal system in the United States, I would receive no justice. I was also afraid that I would be murdered in prison. I later arrived in Cuba, where I am currently living in exile as a political refugee.
That was Assata Shakur speaking in 1998 in an open letter to the previous pope. Interestingly enough, the pope also will be going to Cuba and served as a crucial secret intermediary in the thawing of relations between the United States and Cuba. Our guests are Medea Benjamin and Danny Glover, two people who have long fought from their various perches, from the activism of Code Pink to Danny Glover as a world-renowned actor, director, activist. Danny, what will happen with Assata Shakur? There is a multi-million-dollar bounty on her head. She has had political asylum in Cuba for decades. Are you concerned about what will happen?
Well, from the standpoint of the Cuban government, they've made it very clear that there's no... The discussion about Shakur, about her, is not on the table. They've made that very clear. I don't know what this country, the United States, will determine what they'll do in terms of what happens to in this situation. I'm not aware of anything that's happening in terms of the discussion. So I would be taking a leap to say anything about that. And I think it's important that we're very careful about what we say about about her as well, you know, at this particular point in time, because she's still in a dangerous situation, even though the Cuban's government has taken every step to protect her livelihood and protect her. But it's still a very dangerous situation. So I'm not so sure what the dynamics are about that and what discussions, if any, are happening about that.
Medea Benjamin.
Well, every time we've taken a delegation, we meet with high-level Cuban officials, and we always ask that question. We want the Cubans to know that there's a lot of support for Asada here in the United States. And they always answer the same way, which is that it's not on the table. We feel we have the total right to give political asylum to people in Cuba, and that we have gotten on the path of normalizing relations with the United States without that being on the table, and we're going to stick to that.
Medea Benjamin, this issue of high-level politicians in the United States, not to mention CEOs, you have a lot to do with what these delegations are doing in Cuba.
You mean
for example, corporate heads that would like to do business in Cuba, like the embargo lifted. Talk about some of the people.
Well, the CEO of Google has been there, Eric Schmidt. The head of Tom Donahue of the Chamber of Commerce, a very right-wing guy. The head of Cargill has been there, and actually one of the Cargill staff people is a key lobbyist in opening relations with Cuba. I met the CEO of Cargill and talked to him, and he said that not only are they interested in selling their GMO, I must say, products to Cuba, but they're interested in buying organic products from Cuba. Look, this is up to the Cubans. We can be very critical of the companies that are going to Cuba and worried about what it means for the Cuban people, but Cuba's had over 50 years to be worried about this. They've also had time to deal with CEOs from other countries. And I think we should trust that they're going to make the decisions that they feel are best for them. And I think we can do things like support the co-ops, support the very small businesses, do things that kind of shape the economy that our friends in Cuba would like to see. But it's really obviously up to the Cubans.
And I think Medea is right when she says that the Cubans have been dealing with countries, other countries in the world, and other CEOs in the world, other major corporations in the world, and have developed some guidelines in reference to it, and modified those guidelines on terms at different points in time in reference to the relationship that they want to have. And that's important. And they've been very steadfast in that, in developing that.
And what about health care? What can the United States learn from Cuban health care? The system, the doctors,
everything.
Yeah,
really. I mean, it's amazing. This very poor, poor country is able to have family doctors, so you can go down the street where the doctor will come to your house at a fraction of the cost that we pay for health care. And that Cuba's developed this high-tech bio industry that's producing things that would be so positive here in the United States to stop amputations for limbs of people who have diabetes, to help in cancer treatment.
Yeah.
So there's so much to learn on both the preventive end as well as the high-tech end.
The World Health Organization recently declared Cuba the first country in the world to eliminate the transmission of HIV and syphilis from mother to child.
Yeah.
And they say that's because of the preventive care that they have.
Yeah.
You know, just this weekend, there was a Klan rally in Columbia, South Carolina, protesting the taking down of the Confederate battle flag. Mm-hmm. It's interesting in this country, as the Confederate battle flag goes down, the Cuban flag goes up in Washington, D.C., right here. Danny Glover, if you can talk about the Black Lives Matter movement here, and can you relate it to anything that you see going on in Cuba right now?
Well, the Black Lives Movement, along with the Dream Defenders and so many other groups, I think there's a process also that is happening in their own politicalization. And what they're beginning to do is to find these relationships with other movements around the world. So there's an international view as well as the kind of perspective from inside right here. And I think that we're
where it is, in fact, there's a conference this week, next week, beginning in Cleveland, I believe, of Black Lives Matter. And it's really encouraging to see how they're able to frame not only their relationship with other movements, particularly the Palestinian movement, and to begin, I believe, the kind of radicalization that's necessary for young people. And I think that they're opening up another space. How that connects with supporting groups like NUMSA in South Africa and other groups, you know, the groups, and I'm sure that they would want to connect with within Cuba, groups that they would want to connect within Venezuela, of young people who've used their platform as a way of transformation and changing their society as well.
And the consciousness of Black Cubans, the whole Afro-Cuban population there, is something that you have long been interested in.
Well, we've been talking, and we think it's important, and let me note that this is the decade of the Afro-descendant. This decade, the UN has designated that. In fact, Venezuela is going to have a major assembly, a conference there in 2016. And I think that and Cuba is going to play a major role in that. And this is a conversation and a possibility to have us another discussion about Afro descendants in Cuba. The Cuban Revolution has done extraordinary things to change the life of African descendants, but there's still more to be done. Remittances that are sent here don't go often to Black Cubans. They often go to white Cubans. So I think there's more to be done. And so I think it opens up the space for us, for progressives, young progressives, to now begin to have a relationship and connect with young Cubans as well.
In this last minute that we have, Medea Benjamin, you're holding a party outside the embassy?
Yes, we're going to have a party all day long, dancing and music for people who are in the D.C. area to come on down. It's going to be great. And, Amy, I also want to say that we're taking a group to Guantanamo in November, and people who are concerned about the issue of the Guantanamo base can join us and go. We're leaving from Miami, but we're going to Guantanamo, and we're going to be part of a Cuban seminar on foreign military bases. So it's a great thing for people to do.
And your assessment, Danny Glover, finally, of President Obama in these last seconds that we have and the path he is taking now?
Well, I think certainly we have to commend him on what he's done, and there's still more that he could do while he's still in office here. And certainly, I'm very proud for what he did. But we also have to acknowledge that the nations in the region said that we don't want to have anything to do at any meeting unless the Cubans are there at the meeting.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Danny Glover, Medea Benjamin. That does it for our show. Again, today, an historic day in Washington, D.C. We are right here in front of the Cuban embassy. Today, the Cuban flag will go up for the first time in 54 years. Special thanks to Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Dennis Moynihan, Julie Crosby, Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felton, Amin Sheikh, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org to see all of our coverage of Cuba over the years. Thanks so much for joining us.